sorry.
No, 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 no. What will you lead me to the state?
How should the text of the Nusach HaTfilah, composed by the Anshei Kesis HaGedolah, be utilized in the spreading of later works of classical Machshava, Hashkafa, and more recent Jewish spirituality?
What was the beginning of these questions?
How should the text of the Nusach HaTfilah, the Siddur,
how should
the Siddur be used? Should be studying more in terms of Machshava, from a sitter, is there a derech to which we can gain an approach?
Is it part? In what capacity are you doing this? Something more for your own enlightenment, your own spiritual growth, or you deal with this as a text to be taught, and to communicate, you say this to Buddha, you say this to us. I think if someone came to me who knew nothing, and wanted to start learning a little bit about Yiddishkeit, and I had to pick a single text up in the Siddur. It's a conspectus of parties of historical elements, but first and foremost of the basis of a minute. In some texts practically have a sikkum of the Rambam Yom Kippur, Yigdal, for instance. If we don't have that, the basis for the nature of our relationship with the Ben Shalom, which is in part expressed in abstract theological terms, and in part is realized and implemented through the tefillah itself, that's the best of the basis for it. If someone is very well advanced, and he's learning all along, or use the Siddur in that way? Possibly not, or certainly not to such an extent. But there too, I can't say if you take Siddur that, or even take Shmoneh Esrei, certainly some things which are very near and dear to us, which are not included in the Bakoshis. No bakosha about children, neither about having children, nor about raising children, nor about slach with the children, how they develop, even though that certainly is much more important to us than many other things that are mentioned. But the gadol encompasses the kind of aspirations which one has for oneself and for the public square, the public sector as well. But beyond that, the stance which a person assumes before the Rebbe Shleilom, Tefillah Kiyat of the Hishpach Sicho, that's what the Siddur gives. Now that's if you deal with Tefillah in the narrow sense, Tefillah, that's a primary bakasha. As much as you have in the Siddur, it's not in that vein. The parts you take from Tanakh, Hallel being a prime example. Yes, if you question whether it should be utilized, I think certainly so. How? As I said, depends on who you are and to whom you try to communicate. But I think it's an extremely powerful tool. think the schools which do that, which I think the Haredi school thinks were more than the others. I know that it's a big to-do with them. They have a sitter. The kid gets a sitter. It's a big... Remember the Sinai. It's an extra matter. Of course, Siddur is itself a text which has a large literature built around it. It's a dual text from the tradition of Siddurim from the outset, classical Siddurim, from Avraham Cohen and Segur down. The Siddur serves a dual purpose. It gives you text the tefillah, and it gives the halachas. And more modern siddurim, they probably do that a bit less. Either if it's less necessary, or that for that there are other kinds of avenues. They'll also tell you but most of the modern siddurim will only tell you what you need in order to use them. When you say Ram Natsech, when you say Tachno, etc. The older Siddurim had much more than that. Or bring back Rebbe Siddur. If the Shabbos are there. But both the Siddur itself and that which is around it, I think is very, very important. And bear in mind that many times important issue of Ashkofer Machshover can turn on a single word. Do you include a center of Adab Chomes Tzmiya HaKadosh Shur Secha? Because you can hear what's happening in Shur. So from a certain point of view, Kivinu Kol HaYerim also includes the same idea. There is a difference. First of all, what's happening in Shua is Lashon Chazal with associations. One of the six questions which Rabbi says the person asks the Yabadin, Sipitzeli Shua. Secondly, substantively, the sense of expectancy, the aspiration, the yearning, the longing, which goes together with Tzipia. It's written from tikva. We use the term tikva, the English equivalent of hope, or spare French, very often in almost an offhand kind of way. You ask someone, are you going on vacation next week? I hope so. Very, very neutral, very powerful. There's nothing powerful to turn to with support. Sometimes in modern Hebrew they use it in a sense which is much more powerful, in Chazal's sense, what the Tzefi is, what the GIP is going to be, or what the weather forecast is going to be, Tachzib Ekzavir, the Tzefi, those. Let's commercialize it a bit, debase it a bit. In Chazal, I'm not saying that every tzipia is for Yeshua. The minor matter is also someone who has a lamp burning on Shabbos. He's waiting for the lamp to be extinguished. Yeshua mitzapeh. So it's not Yeshua mitzapeh, he's waiting for Mashiach. But it's also more than just saying he's in Mekaveh. It's an immediacy and it's a power. That's just in two brief words. I remember when my children were very young, they used to have a group called the Rabbi's Sons. The sons of Phila Bonimjor. Penka was one of them, what's his name?
Jay.
No, what's his name?
Chait.
One of the Chaits was one of them.
Weinberger?
Yeah, these kind of and my kids, when they were young, used to listen to it all the time. And one of the highlights was one of the songs on the record was Sev Levinat Chavuz Asmiach, and when they came down full force, it was happening with Yeshua. And I used to hear it, and I used to think, my daughter, they're right. I don't say what's happening with Yeshua, but I say it was Hashkins, but I miss it. Yes.
Clearly, there's Orthodox Judaism has changed, you know, over the last 20, 50, 100 years, and whether women's education or a number of areas. And there's been change also that's been done by the conservative movement. And sort of the boundaries of legitimate change is something that's argued about a lot, you know, between different streams within Orthodoxy, whether more liberal, more conservative, lowercase conservative streams. My question is, where, how do we know the boundary between legitimate change and evolution and illegitimate or, you know, capital C conservative change and evolution?
No, essentially, from the reservoir, the pool of those that preceded you. Set certain standards and set certain limits, certain parameters. You know from what's written, certain texts, and you know probably from Shimush. Fortunately, many people today don't get Shimush that people used to get, but still there are avenues where you can say certain people respond to certain questions, Hashkafas or suggested changes. What they tolerate, what they're open to, what they reject. And very often what they reject is not necessarily a suggested phenomenon per se, but some ancillary factor. And the ancillary factor may be who's suggesting it. Something which is neutral, but which is being suggested by someone who they don't trust, First of all, they don't want that person's status to be enhanced in the public community. Secondly, with regard to him, the concern about the slippery slope is always that much greater. And that also becomes a factor. What would be the sociological implications? Many of the issues come by the sort of public policy sector have to do not so much with the change itself, but with where it's headed, by what is energized, what's the spirit which animates it, and for all that exposure to Gedolim, hopefully direct, if not direct, listening from writing, can be very, very helpful. Sometimes it's a question of a response, not whether it's up or down, pro or anti, but how much force, how much vehemence, to what they, which kind of suggestion, they simply demur, and by what are they shocked? That's probably true that there are certain changes which are cumulative in the course of time, and some things which were unthinkable at one point maybe become gradually palatable and accepted. It's true in terms of any social phenomenon, through the language, dress, and arguments are likewise. And some of them are things which are not strictly speaking of offer, but with regard to which, at a certain point, it's clear no one would agree to it, and eventually become accepted. Eventually, women's education. Think of women speaking Leviathan. 30 years ago, you never saw it. not the Haredi circles, not the modern Orthodox circles. Today, yeah, Baba is including Haredim and people born in Haredim, and Pritzipem and Tzavtzev. Other things people reject, they don't want to put. Some people let them speak in the Bible, let them speak in the Chuppah. So I take it your question is not so what Buddha would not be acceptable, but what's going to help you make judgments on a certain issue. Someone once came, it was a group that was organized here. People want to deal with certain issues, machshava, social issues, etc., etc. And it included people who were by and large Anshei Shleimeinu, but with, I guess it might be described left wing, some left wing tendencies, or a little nice in time with left wing tendencies. And the question was, the journey this came up. So one of my friends who decided to go went to the Shlomo Zalman, and he asked him, should he go, shouldn't he go? He said, don't go. He says, so dimension or Sibirinian? Because the people are involved, what kind of crowd you have over there, or because of the substance? He said, both. This person told me this. I went to Shlomo Zalman myself. For myself, asking. I asked him, did you join this particular group? He says, do as you understand. And then he told me, Rabbi Shapiro is about Chuvanim Shivyas Shalom Metrem. Why the Chuvanim? Bayavanim. He asked him to come and listen to me, and I'll tell you what to do. So Rabbi Shapiro said, Chuvanim means, Kindle, you go and do as you understand. So I said to him, but I heard, I didn't tell him the name, but he of course knew, I heard that someone asked you, I told him definitively not to go. So he said, never mind that Talmud. He was a Talmud of mine, so him I could tell. I thought I was not Talmud. And I was left to my own devices. Other considerations too. It's partly an evaluation of the past, and partly an attempt to predict the future. We find with regard to certain possible developments sociologically, there is mechayev to look at the future. You don't wait till tomorrow till your son's going to begin asking questions. You have to anticipate. It tells you, if what should you tell him? You have to think about where you live, what kind of community are you in, what's your family structure like, what's your educational structure like, and then try to deal with issues. But these are matters which partly have to do with the municipal days, narrowly speaking, and partly have to do with the public square, and with regard to both, you have to try to anticipate what's going to be. Admittedly, sometimes the kind of questions that come up are not questions of which they're strictly speaking. I'll give you an example. Back in the 60s, when the first cracks in the Iron Curtain were developing, the SSSJ, came up, the issue came, the terror world. Supportive, to be against it. And by and large, the Haredigerim coming out of the tradition of Eastern Europe, or you knew Shtadlanis, and no one ever thought of trying to fight anything, almost to a man, the said, Al-Tiru, can't be careful not to arouse the Russian bear or any other bear, and what we can do on the QT we'll do, Do I smoke people out? And they're worried about the issues. They were, but they had not been raised in activist tradition. They came to the Rav at the time when I was there. I pressed very hard to be supported. The Rav was not in the forefront dealing with this, but he understood and gave them support anyway. I don't remember he went, he said much in public, but he certainly gave them a sense that it was worth doing, that it was important. And that to a great extent reflected modes of thought, modes of operation. That's something you could translate into moves of this, narrowly speaking. The greatest thing was not to be in a very similar echo. But that in itself is a question which, about which issues of Ashkafa come up. And to what extent should one be innovative and pushing? To what extent should you take guidance from Islabeim? In this respect, there's no question today the climate, speaking of YU particularly, has changed dramatically. There are many Bachim there. I'm talking about the Bnei Teru, the Teru Bachim, who don't think of thinking. Any question comes up, yes, this is Rebbe, yes, this here, yes, that here. When I was there, things are very different in that respect. Yes.
Some, even I think a lot of times, shunned philosophy.
Speak a little louder.
Yes. Some have shunned studying philosophy, even traditional Jewish works of philosophy, saying that it counters the idea of a moon of Shuta. I was wondering, given what we face today in both cultural and academic norms in our community, would it make sense to both generally and pedagogically to tilt towards embracing the moon of Shuta in the sense of maybe studying less of things like more Neluchim, or maybe the idea of the moon of Shuta is less palatable, less possible today?
So the question, what should be more palatable?
And moon of Shuta, the idea of encouraging moon of Shuta and not being as in certain, with certain elements as philosophical as Hashgacha or
what was the term that you used?
Emunah Shuta. Emunah, simple faith.
Emunah Shuta, I didn't say that anymore. Listen, this is an issue which has been dealt with for an awfully long time. Partly by way of perceiving what you think ought to be and what you think is. Take a simple example. Where did everything start? What did Avraham Avinu? What did Avraham Avinu have? You open up a Rambam, you open up the Droshim, and you get such drastically different book pictures. In the Medrash itself, the 2 days, what age Avraham hikir es beiro? So one day is when he's 3 years old. And it's a remez for it. It's Eki Yosha Avraham Bekoel, 172, lived to be 175, 3 years old. Now, 3 years old is an age at which the first inkling of anything especially called religious faith comes to a person. Infancy. If you speak in terms of miraculous birth at the age of 3, that's not philosophy, it's not theology, it's not wrestling, it's not grappling. It's absolute spontaneous, as you call it, munim shuta. The Rambam passes the two other, there's another day in the Medrash, which is two gilsois. One gils is 40, yeah, one gils is 40. The Rambam not only does he accept that day, but he goes on, which in the Medrash you don't have, which the Rambam conjectured, what did he do till he was 40? Till he was 40? Went about the Avodah Zarah, followed the popular religion, idolatrous as it was, for decades. And then he began to mature, and he began to think, and he began to ponder, and he began to examine. And I'm describes how partly it was a sense of social justice, his moral and ethical sense, partly his religious sense, and all of this brought him to certain conclusions. And the conclusion is that the Avraham Avinu's dual message, the two messages which Avraham Avinu brought to the world, one was Yifud Hashem, and the other was Midas Chesed. That's the way Chazal conceived it, that's the way it appears in Yeshayahu. And both were harnessed, and Rambam emphasized they were harnessed together to make him whatever the Sheva and Maimon. And then once he attained that, so the Rambam describes how he was a great evangel, and he went around to all the places, and held these huge rallies, etc., etc. Neither they in the Medrash had a source. It's not as if someone started with, we read the passage, Eger Shavu Makeli, and decided, oh, that's what it means. After he thought that after Rabbi Fidu was 3 years old, and he was from Kabbalah, Babas Hashem, so he thought he was a good peg which to hang your hat. But at least one thought, woman thought the other, because that's what the Sukkah's ideal. Rabbi Fidu must be the ideal Geir, the ideal Maimin. What do you idealize? William James, about his religious experience, speaks of once born and twice born. The once born are what you call the Buddha Pshuta, which could be one of two things. It could be just Pshuta in the sense of superficial, very simple, something that's Pashut. Not a sense of being simple, but a sense of being straight. A shofar could be pashut, a kodesh could be pashut, a mudashut could be either. Can be profound, but simplicity profound. Now you ask yourself, what's better? Those are two questions. One is a question of, ultimately, what kind of a person is it better to be when you get the other members? What kind of person is better to be when you're right here? Straightforward, emunah pshuta, or sophisticated, philosophically oriented, theologically oriented, emunah, which is asked all kinds of questions, given all kinds of answers. Now that's one kind of question, which is better. There's another question, which is better, not in terms of the ultimate destination, but in terms of the process. Now one might assume that ultimately it's better to be very simple, straightforward, naive. But to think, if at present that's not where you are, at present you are all tied up with all kinds of issues, trying to work out our world, Ashkofer. The only way to reach the naivete is to start out by clearing the debris of the sophistication. And until you've cleared your mind out of all that garbage, from that point of view, you're not going to get the naivete. One may assume the reverse. It's ultimately, it's best to be sophisticated, understanding. Das, that's what defines humanity. That's Talib al-Hakim for the Rambam. But in order to attain that kind of level, so you've got to start with a firm base, which is not skeptical. We're not about skepticism. We're talking about trying to understand. We need a firm base of naivete, which will assure that in your quest for understanding, for there being a vaskil, you're not going to fall out of bed. And you're not going to become just another village atheist. But these are two separate questions. You don't always have the same degree of choice or control as to which you prefer, particularly with regard to the process. There are cultural considerations. Tennyson, been born in the 17th century, in a way would look much different. But since he was born in the 19th century, so then he tells you he didn't find God questioning and studying and thought, etc. He found them in internal experience. The heart felt, and that settled the matter. Aquinas would not have loved that. Aquinas didn't live in the 19th century either. The sun was showing him glorified inquiry. He takes what we would consider to be some ultimate spiritual values and transmutes them into philosophic issues. Tshuva and Eved Elokim and Aved, etc. But before he gets to all of that, first of all, he has a Shara Yichud, which puts on the table the question whether God exists or not. No more, no less. And many yeshivas, they like Rabbi Reb Chaya because of his Musa, of Frumkeit, but they wouldn't touch Shara Yichud. If they could have banned it, they would have banned it. Because if they were banned it, they skipped it. Of course, part of the reason that he was able to do that, it was all loaded dice. Klemosh, he and the Kuzari, were writing a tradition of Platonic dialogues. Platonic dialogue is for real. You don't have trumped up questions and trumped up answers. A real discussion between Socrates and whoever was to be, this is a Thalacia. That tradition in the larger philosophic world gradually wound itself down. And yet people continued the form, the genre, but didn't continue the real philosophic quest. It was self-evident as to where you were. So if you lived in an age in which the sea of faith was once full, so you could allow yourself the luxury of asking these questions. And then playing it out, all the good guys won. You can't play that way after you. So no one today would go about, imagine a high school class, well, that's what a person would teach and throw him out of his ear. So much of it becomes culturally conditioned. Even the ideals are culturally conditioned. I don't think we need to choose between the two. And I say that in a double sense. First of all, we don't need to think in terms of Mishpat Echad Yalacha. Some people, for them, everyone should do his best. Partly because they couldn't cope with sophistication. And even if they could, they will have a greater sense of religious faith, religious existence, if they don't go through all of that, and vice versa. But it's not only that. It's not a question for some people, this is better than others. My own sense is, and I believe this deeply, we don't want to choose between one of these two. One of my children, I thought, had slightly intellectualistic inclinations. When he's bar mitzvah, I quoted it from Wordsworth's poem. the child is father of the man. Becoming normally, you know what happens sometimes, bar mitzvahs. Today you're a man. And the message I gave to him was, the child is father of the man. Don't become too much of a man. Leave something to the child. It's not easy. I try to do it for myself too. Not just advice I give my children. But I think many people, I have vividly religious experience when I was 8 years old, which I had great difficulty replicating subsequently. So I don't think that one wants to eradicate the child in him. Without getting involved in the words worthy in apotheosis of the child, not that. Maturity and not remaining, not idealizing primitivism, but leaving that as a fact of one's personality. Someone asked me about tefillah. You want to push the version of all these philosophers? Chas v'shalom. Filoni, Yad Hashem Yishpech Sichoi, that's the only, he was a big philosopher. Lifnei Hashem Yishpech Sichoi. So let's not reject one or the other. Let's have the capacity to be more Catholic in our orientation with lowercase c. And work with both elements. I think this is something which the Rav insisted on. I think I felt this before I gave to him, but I don't know if you are you familiar with this theme of the Rav's writings? Familiarize yourself. Read his essence of Chaim Halev. And it's true, I knew a primal. The height of innocence, like a baby. A goyin, a goyin. I have to speak to him after he finished the lecture. Over to him, Mr. Ben Guta. It was a good, the Eilim liked it. And if we were by mitzvah boys, we'd be able to call that. And Lord speaks over there about these qualities. He has an essay on Talmud Torah, or something or other, Gurat Dev Shado, the best introduction to his thought. And this is the central point. There's different categories of the world of Kabbalah, which he used over there, with the sense of great intellectual powers, and utmost in humility and simplicity, because dealing with the Menschle. Yes?
Somewhat related to the question just asked, but since we're between the Yom HaTzmaut and Yom Yerushalayim, can I ask the Rebbe's thoughts on the nature of the miraculous at the moment in time? Particularly with regard to recognizing events that occurred in Minas Israel that have been described as miraculous. I have somebody I know, and I don't know whether this represents a trend, who does not celebrate Yom HaTzmaut. Because out of the belief that after reading modern or more revisionist historical accounts of the situation, doesn't think that it actually qualifies as a miraculous event, and therefore, based on that, doesn't celebrate. I don't want to really discuss the issue of celebrating or not, but generally, when we think in terms of events that occur in modern times, is there a practical model that we can apply to these events in order to identify those that are miraculous and those that
I know the kind of attitudes that you're describing. Now the question that you raise, I guess, lends itself to being divided into two. And this includes the halacha involved as well. One is it's an isolated incident which happened to one, and then maybe somebody will say it was a medical miracle. Someone was ill with cancer and he was told 2 years ago he couldn't live more than 2 months, and here he is 2 years later and he's still around. Things of that kind. Or he fell down from the sixth floor and survived, etc. That's an isolatedness. Maybe for the purpose of that, you need to make a judgment, and then a lofty judgment. This particular phenomenon fit in this category. I don't think it has anything to do with the issue that you raised with your mitzvah. Let's assume for a moment, I'm not sure that I assume it, but let's assume for a moment that these people who you're talking about are right. Best is filling why you also in my day. And that anybody who before Muhammad Shesh Layamim or before Muhammad Ashikul would have sat down to see how many tanks and how many planes and how many soldiers and how many fighting spirit, etc., etc., etc. All the calculus provided the conclusion that this is a better team. Push up the shove, they're going to win. I would take him aside and say, I'm not going to argue with you about military history, I don't know anything about it. But let me ask you, use a little historical imagination. Put yourself 50 years before, 70 years before, a century before. Not in the Middle Ages. Put yourself in your grandparents' position. Maybe they came from Morocco. Maybe they came from Western Europe, certainly they came from Eastern Europe. Someone would have come to them and then told them, you should know, 50 years, it's going to be a Yeshua Nazi soil, 600,000 strong, and they're going to have an army which is going to beat the hell out of seven adjoining nations. What are the responsible? Ishtagata? What are you out of your mind? So do I have to sit and make a judgment by Yom HaTzmaut whether technically, as I have to decide something mukhtse or not, whether the eve of Chavish Yeshti, Chavish Hashichu, whether if war would start, who would win? The very thought that you get to the ball game, mind-boggling. So in order to feel Yad Hashem and Ashgocha, moving in history, the modern period, I don't need to sit and make judgments about military history or a football game and have to decide who has a better place kicker. The situation itself. Think about it for a moment. Put yourself back in when the Yeshuva started. Third quarter of the 19th century. Who would have thought it would have imagined? Mi milel, mi pilel. So that whole development, building up of yeshuv, with the capacity, the will, the energy to build itself up militarily, economically, socially, to the point where it could challenge. Imagine his empire at one level, and all these Arab countries at the other level. So that's nothing. But if I should prove that somebody fell out of the seventh floor, the Empire State Building, and he's still alive, so for that he'll celebrate a day. Makes no sense. Now the question here, I guess, would return if he wants to know whether it's a halal or the like. I can understand you say halal has to be a particular ness. So then we'll argue about a halachic issue. What is the halachis and what is halal? What do you say, bracha? when you say Shosh Nisim Lavisenu, when you say Shosh Nisim Lavisenu, they say the Zalta say that said, etc. That would be an issue. But that should have nothing to do with the weight, the significance which one attaches to Yom HaTzvi, the Yom Yerushalayim. These issues, of course, clearly we've got the Yom HaTzvi, but to a great extent these prevailed with Yom Yerushalayim as well. Most of you are too young to remember what was Yom Yerushalayim. It's not what happened to Yom Yerushalayim itself. 7 weeks before that, the time the Nasser closed the straits in Aqaba, the fear, the panic, the concern, people thought it was second shore. We lived in America at the time, and my sister lived here. It's not very capable. We could pay for tickets, send the kids. You would risk your own life, risk. You have children, you leave children there. And then, that happened subsequently. I'm alive. So anybody wants to know whether you say Shema for your door, let's handle this without a block. Cry about somebody. That was a philosophic issue, which has to do with the question of miracles in general, where you have a whole spectrum. Now, Rambam says, practically everything is an S. And the Rambam doesn't say nothing is an S, but it certainly diminishes the provenance, the prevalence, or at least says these nisim are not quite nisim in the ordinary sense of the term, they're plugged into the system and programmed for the outset. And then in between, those who feel that indeed he's seeing Yad Hashem, but he doesn't quite see it's technically an S. It can be predicted, it can be observed daily. And then there are people who are under the impact of Hume's critique of miracles. You can't say something's a miracle until you've excluded every other possibility of natural causation. Between Hume and Tennyson, I go to Tennyson. So, I understand the people, where they're coming from. But this is, in a sense, what Chazal called Ktani Amana. Those small minds and small hearts. And the issue is not bottom of an issue of deciding, as you have to decide whether an egg is muktzeh or not. It's an issue which has to do where you stand vis-a-vis Shemaditamit. Where you see the Ben Shloilim in history and in yourself and your own life. I don't think we need to get too hung up on the question of whether you can take a label, slap it on what happened, sinness. There's a discussion about this back in the, what was it, I guess it must have been 91, when during the Gulf War, and all kinds of missiles were being sent, and at bottom, almost no one was really affected. And this whole issue blossomed, and S. Some of the same talk you heard, we got to the shelling from Gush Katif. Hundreds, maybe thousands of shells have been sent over. And almost no fatalities. And people speak to us in Ness. Far be it for me to say it's not a Ness. I'd rather believe too much than believe too little. But from my standpoint, coming back to the struggle point, the fact that Kibbutz Sa'ad, or the equivalent, exists altogether, placed within the context of Islamic development since the 19th century, that for me is much of a mess as the shells that the misfired. I mean, that's my perspective.
I'm wondering, you mentioned, you alluded a little bit earlier to activism, and especially with regard to the Soviet Jewry movement.
I don't mean to glorify myself. I wasn't in the firing lines. But
you know, you mentioned that, you know, you might encourage something like that.
I did encourage it.
Right. So today, when especially young people, I think, are, you know, I guess tempted to get involved with things that aren't necessarily centrally Jewish issues, you know, they obviously their desire to be involved is rooted in their Jewish identity. But how far do you think we should go in encouraging that?
You know, that don't answer how far questions. There are certain issue attitudes towards activism, towards pacifism, etc. And these, to a great extent, color or even dictate quality and content of one's response to historical events. But that's an ironclad rule. It doesn't mean that you fight for everything, you fight for nothing. One has to exercise judgment, which has to do partly how important is the cause, do you prove it or don't prove it, partly compare that to others. Ask yourself what price, if any, you pay for getting involved. All these things have to be considered. One of the things that will enter that whole calculus will certainly be, attitudinally, how you feel either about activism in general, or activism about universal causes specifically. Would I be likely to encourage people to get involved with this today more than many of my peers? The answer is yes. Would I push every one of them to do God for every cause? The answer is no.
Leaving aside the financial considerations involved, should American Orthodox Jewish day schools emphasize the role of Holocaust education within its high school curriculum, and specifically organize trips for 12th graders in high school to Eastern Europe to see the wide range of Jewish communal life that existed before the Holocaust, and as well to see the concentration camps? Or should such trips occur only after a year of Torah study in Israel for those who will study in Israel?
To my mind, it would be sort of preferable to wait till later. But the question is, will they be around to go? And maybe other factors, even if they'll be around, maybe that's such an experience will stimulate them Jewishly at different levels. Some people come on birthright. The stimulus they get is simply towards the basic Jewish identity. The studies which have indicated that people who've been on birthright are much less likely to marry a shiksa. So all kinds of considerations, what would influence them at one point or another point. In terms of the maturity and the capacity, the emotional capacity, as well as the ability to garner the requisite knowledge, to bond at least the European Jewry. Of course, someone who's for a year has been at the yeshiva. The shach and the goyim mean more to him than they meant when he was a kid in high school. But I say there are other facts involved as well. Broadly speaking, I think what a person can get going to such a trip is partly a sense of the horrors of the shore per se, but very important is not the thing of Eastern European Jewry only in terms of that. You have to give them a sense of the richness, the depth, quality of the life that was destroyed. In all of its variety. And different people need different messages. People who come out of a relatively secular background need to get a sense of what the spiritual religious life was like. People who come to yeshivas, maybe need to know what the Islamic parents was. If you go to the Warsaw Cemetery, which is a huge cemetery, I think about 150,000 crowd there, if I remember correctly. We asked the people who were in charge of the cemetery, what are the most visited kvarim? So the most visited kever was the cemetery is the oil of the Kram and Tziv, and number two is Paris's kever. A lot of people don't know that. They don't know what it's all about. I think it's very important to get a sense of that. But there's not only a quest for knowledge. We encourage people to go to Eastern Europe, if we encourage them. Not just an exercise in history lesson. We want them to bond existentially, to see themselves as continuing, as identifying, recognizing the greatness, the majesty, and being able to recapitulate their own experience vicariously, what you believe that world is like. You walk in Vilna, the stones where the Goyim went to Shul, the Goyim. It's a different planet. Or on a lesser scale, you come to the Yelvis Medrash, not too far from Warsaw. You think in your own mind, thousands of people there from Damian, people were literally hanging out of the rooftops, out of the ceiling. That's an experience you're unlikely to get sitting in Ramat Gan, or sitting in Potomac. And if you get something, a reconstruction of that, it's very enriching. And thirdly, hopefully, one gets a determination to continue where they left off. If I speak for myself, this connection, I was very determined to be in Chinuch, etc., long before I went to Eastern Europe. And nevertheless, despite hesitations I had about going before I went twice, I came back much more determined, much from mother's family, which was decimated there, people involved in chinuch, the kind of chinuch that I identify with, but even with different kind of chinuch. Tzio Yisrael, this was the so-called the modern yeshivish element, or the yeshivish modern element, however you want to define it. And it was very much involved. You see where these people were killed, and you feel differently about picking up where they left off. So I think it's important to go. I say again, a 20-year-old is better equipped to understand all of this than a 17-year-old. Partly because of his personal maturity, partly because in the interim, he or she has hopefully become that much more Jewish, that much more Talmudic, and therefore cares much more as pointed his or her point of departure for bonding with Eastern European life, or with North African life for that matter, is much greater because of where he's been in the interim. But, again, the question is, will he be there when you call for him? So, I don't know whether there's been much change in this respect for financial consideration side, you say, but I understand there's been some cutback on this for financial considerations this year. But it's something which I think can be helpful. Not that everybody needs it, maybe some people don't. But the group of people going to yeshivas or other parallel schools could benefit from it, and which, as an educator, I think we should try to make use of. Okay. Next week, Mr. Shim, we're back and make a discussion on Wednesday. I'll be back on Monday. So.
What was that last kickoff where they left off?